Rise. The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
You may be seated. We are here this morning. Our first case is 11-2126, State of Ohio versus Donnie Howard. For the appellant, Lynn Nostein.
Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court. This case presents the issue of whether a sex offender whose classification and related registration requirements are governed by Megan's Law can be sentenced under the current version of Revised Code 295099 for violating a duty of his duty to notify the sheriff of a change in his residence address. The Court of Appeals held that a Megan's Law offender could only be sentenced for a subsequent failure to notify crime under the penalty section that was in effect when the offender was originally classified under Megan's Law. In their view, to permit sentencing under the current version of 295099 in cases like Donnie Howard's would be an improper application of the Adam Walsh Act to a Megan's Law offender. We believe that decision was erroneous for three reasons. First one is fairly straightforward. The first reason is that the penalty section under 295099, although it does set forth penalties for the violations of sex offender reporting requirements, it was not actually enacted as part of the Adam Walsh Act. The penalty section was enacted by Senate Bill 97, which was a different bill, a different piece of legislation than the bill that actually contained the Adam Walsh Act, which was...
So what's the timeline in relationship to the Adam Walsh Act with the penalty section you're referencing?
It was enacted at the same time, and it took effect on the same date, but it was a separate piece
of legislation.
It was
a different section than, or a different statute than the one that was in place when Mr. Howard was sentenced, correct?
It does have different requirements, yes.
Different requirements and different penalties.
Yes, different penalties. You're right.
So what's the distinction? What are the penalties that are problematic here?
When he was first classified, a failure to notify of a change of address was a felony of the fifth degree. Under the current...
What was the penalty?
Well, that would be a maximum of 12 months.
Okay.
Under the current version of 295099, the court isn't sort of, you have to look back to the prior sex offense to see what the felony level of it was,
right,
to determine what the felony level of the new failure to notify offense is.
And the failure to notify based on his?
His prior was an F1 rape, so his failure to notify was an F1.
All right, and the...
which would carry a maximum of 10 years at that time.
Okay, and when he was sentenced, he was apprised of the fact that there will be a duty. He would be categorized as a sex offender with a duty to register, correct?
Yes, he was told he would be characterized as a habitual sex offender at that time.
And what his duty was at that point?
His duty was at that point, I believe, to register into annually for 20 years, and with, I believe, the court decided there should be 20 years of community notification as well.
Okay, and this was a plea, correct?
He pled, yes.
So he knowingly and voluntarily, there's no dispute that at the time he rendered his plea and then was sentenced, it was a knowing and voluntary, and it was based upon his understanding of what a failure to register at that time would constitute.
He was informed of all of that. And we're talking about the plea to the rape. Is that correct?
Yeah, yeah, yes. That's what I'm saying.
Yes, he was informed of all of that information at the time, and he actually was even given a form called an explanation of the duties to register.
And the penalties associated with failure to do so.
Well, it didn't say a penalty. It said that he would be subject to prosecution if he failed to do so, but it didn't list a penalty.
It maybe didn't list it, but one would presume that his attorney informed him of if he was rendering a knowing, involuntary, and intelligent plea here, mm-hmm. what are all the parameters of the consequences of his plea.
Well,
and now those parameters and consequences are changed, and you're arguing, well, there's a new crime, and that new crime is under a new statute section, and therefore we're going to – then what's the purpose of having notified him in the first place about the potential – about the registration and the consequences?
Well, the purpose was so that he would know how to register, that he was required to register and verify and change, notify of a change of residence. He needed to be informed of that. He needed to be informed that he could be prosecuted for a subsequent offense if he failed to do so. His attorney, of course, may have told him that it would be an F5 at that point, but I don't think we can presume that the attorney would not have also said, you know, the legislature has the power to increase penalties, which it does. It might not always be an F5. We don't know that, of course, but it's entirely possible.
But his classification changed because of the attorney general classification, right?
Yes, and then that was vacated under State v. Bodike.
Okay.
So now he's back to being a habitual sex offender at this point.
And you're arguing I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
You're arguing, though he's a habitual sex offender, that the new penalties bump from fifth-degree felony to a first-degree felony if he doesn't register every 90 days. You're saying he has to register
every... I don't think he has to register every 90 days as a habitual sex offender. Okay. I think that would be... So that was his Tier 3.
You're agreeing he's back to once a year, but he still has the same 20-day registration requirement.
Yes, that's correct.
And that's what he was charged with.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that penalty substantially increased from fifth degree to first degree, right?
It did increase, yes, from fifth degree to first degree.
Does the fact that we have found now the imposition of all these penalties to be punitive, does that change that analysis?
No, because the penalty is for the new offense. It's not a... it's not penalizing him again for his prior sex offense. It's for the new offense of failing to register his new address within at least 20 days prior to moving.
But his plea might not have been to that if he had known that it could jump to a first degree felony when he pled to the original offense.
Well, that may be true, but I don't think he's ever moved to withdraw his plea. So, I mean,
'cause nobody knew how we were going to interpret all these statutes. I mean, nobody knew that the Adam Walsh Act would be so harsh. Nobody knew any of this was going to go in the direction it went. So that's pretty, there's no way he would know that to even say, well, I don't want to plea because they might do something really harsh in the future.
Well, I mean, it may seem unfair, but it simply is the case that the legislature has the power to increase penalties if they decide they need to do that. It might be instructive to think just for a moment about the having a weapon under disability offense, because in that situation, there's a prior conviction that creates a disability that says the offender cannot have a weapon. If he's later found to be in possession of a weapon and he's penalized for that, he's not being penalized for that prior offense again. He's being penalized because now he's got a weapon under that disability, and no one seems to have a retroactivity problem with that. It's very similar to what's going on here.
But they knew when he pled that was a criminal offense. And at the time he pled to this one, it was still in the civil classification. Now it's criminal.
Well, he pled to a rape, which was a crime.
But the registration was not considered punitive at the time.
No, it was not under Megan's Law. That's correct.
But failure to register was a crime.
Failure to register is a crime. Even
it was under Megan's Law.
It was under Megan's Law.
It is under the new
law. Yes, sir.
And when OMVI penalties are increased for second and third offenders, there's never been a retroactive problem with those who had already committed one or two DUIs before they committed the third and then subject to the higher penalty. Has there been?
That's not a problem.
If you know.
It's not a problem. And actually, the reason why this court has talked about it before, some in Cook, some in Ferguson, and some cases you talked about in Cook and Ferguson, the idea is that a felon does not have a reasonable expectation of finality in the prior such that he could expect that it would never, ever be the subject of subsequent legislation. He doesn't have that reasonable expectation of finality. This court said so in Ferguson and Cook and cases cited therein.
So an individual has no expectation that a sentence will ever be final is what you're saying?
No.
There can never be a completed sentence with no expectation that the penalties will not increase.
They will not increase for that crime, but he has no expectation that the legislature won't down the road say, because you have this prior, it's going to make a subsequent crime a higher level offense. That's where there's no expectation of finality.
And the crime here was failure to notify of an address. Is that what you're talking about?
To change his residence
address.
So
he did not notify of an address. And the state is seeking a felony of the first degree.
We did, Your Honor.
And in the cases that you're trying to draw analogy to with OMVIs and weapons under disability, they're committing the same crime, i.e. the rape, again, not something ancillary.
That's correct, Your Honor, but I'm not sure what difference that really makes. The bottom line is you're looking to a prior conviction and what the felony level of it was to determine what's going to be the felony level of a new crime, whether it's the same crime or not.
Counsel, he was indicted under the Adam Walsh Act, was he not?
He was, Your Honor.
And he pled to Megan's Law.
Well, yes, the Bodike came out exactly the same day that the indictment was issued. So his Megan's Law classification was reinstated the same day that he was indicted.
He was not reindicted under Megan's Law.
He was not reindicted, Your Honor.
He was indicted under Adam Walsh, pled under Megan's, and can you be indicted under Adam Walsh anymore?
He cannot.
No. Can anyone?
Yes. To the offenders that it applies to, anyone who committed their sex offense after January 1 of 08. Yes.
Can be indicted under Adam Walsh.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
It still applies to those folks. It's just that Mr. Howard committed his rape offense back before 2008. And so it would be unconstitutionally retroactive to apply it to him. That's what Your Honor said in Williams.
And the effect of the change in failure to register sentencing means that some of the cases, they're going to serve more time for failing to register than they served for the original crime, correct?
Well, possibly. In this particular case, we did not oppose the minimum, which was 3 years, and he had served 4 years for the rape. So that's not the case.
But what's the maximum under this one?
Was 10 years.
So you could have someone who serves 2 years for a sex offense, fails to register, and now gets 10 years.
It's possible, Your Honor. I think, but I don't know that that's irrational necessarily. It could be that the legislature's thinking they want to give the worst offenders, the ones with that committed the highest level felonies or the most serious offenses, the greatest incentive to register, to follow through with their duties. And they may believe that making these penalties pretty harsh is a good way to give that incentive.
Are you familiar with our decision or with the case that's pending here, Bruning?
I watched the oral argument, yeah.
All right. Does that have any application to this?
Well, Mr. Howard would fall into that gap if you, Your Honors, find that there is a gap, yes. Because his offense happened after his tier classification and before his Megan's Law classification was reinstated by Bodike. So technically, yes, he would fall into that gap that was being discussed in Bruning, yes.
Mm-hmm.
I will say, though, Mr. Howard has never raised that issue. I don't know that he ever preserved it. I mean, he never moved to dismiss his indictment. He didn't raise that issue on appeal. He only challenged the sentence in the case. So I'm not sure if he's preserved error in that regard.
So he's seeking the application as an habitual offender, and you're seeking the application as a result of the statutory change to increase the penalty.
We're just simply seeking to apply the penalty section that was in effect when he committed this crime of failure to notify.
Okay.
So you're taking what you're saying is the notification obligation that we've already determined does not change because of the punitive nature. You're saying that can stay, but you want to increase the penalty in the Adam Walsh of the Adam Walsh Act.
Well,
so you're taking part of it, which is the most punitive part, and saying that should apply, but we understand that the obligations don't apply because of the retroactivity problem.
I mean, I don't want to concede that the penalty section is part of the Adam Walsh Act because, as I said a little bit ago, it was enacted under a different Senate bill.
But the timing was the same, correct?
It was, Your Honor.
The enactment date was the same and the effective date was the same.
But technically it is a different law, different legislation, and certainly if the General Assembly wanted it to be part of the Adam Walsh Act, they certainly could have made it that way, but they didn't. If there are no further questions from Your Honors, we would respectfully ask that the Second District Court of Appeals decision be reversed, and for asking for a holding that Megan's Law offenders can be penalized under the current version of 2950.99 for subsequent registration violations. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Lachman?
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. My name is Marshall Lachman. I am the attorney for Donnie Howard. I think at issue in this case is whether after Bodike, the sentencing provisions of RC 2950.99, as amended, apply retroactively to a defendant like Donnie Howard, who was previously classified as a habitual sex offender. As discussed at the time of Mr. Howard's original conviction, and classification in 2000, a violation of the duty to notify of a change of address was a fifth-degree felony if the underlying conviction was a felony. Such a violation became a first-degree felony at the time of the enactment of Senate Bill 10 and 97 in 2007 and at the time of Mr. Howard's 2010 conviction for failure to notify. Initially, I think there is a question of what this court has had to consider on at least a few occasions is that gap between the passage of Adam Walsh Act and the court's ruling in Bodike. This exact issue, I think, initially was brought to this court's attention in Gingell. However, because Gingell involved a failure to verify. And under Adam Walsh Act, the requirement for verification changed from, I believe, annually to 90 days. This court didn't get to the issue of penalty because it found that since Gingell was subject to Megan's Law, you couldn't change the reporting requirement, the verification requirement. Therefore, there was no crime, basically, so there was no reason to even go to the issue of penalty.
Well, that is an application of a prospective duty on the defendant that is obviously inextricably linked to the original crime, which is a little different than what the appellant is arguing, which is it's a new crime. And once time passed and he was given the opportunity to do what he was required to do, there was a new offense of failure to notify of address change.
I would argue, Your Honor, that it is a new offense, but it is an offense based on the plea that was entered at the time of the initial rape conviction.
What about the analogy to having a weapons under a disability, which is a brand new crime, and you know you could be a felon and have been sentenced 5 years earlier, maybe not even done any time, but you know you still have that restriction.
You have that restriction, but you are doing at that point you are not allowed to carry a firearm.
Mm-hmm.
At some point in the future, you are found with a firearm. Okay. I believe there's a distinction. That's where I think the distinction between a civil and a criminal remedy. I believe that the criminal offense that comes from failure to notify of a change of address is more civil in nature. It is not a requirement that any person in this state has generally other than someone who has been designated a sexual offender.
Well, how can that be? Because this court already has said in a prior decision now that it's criminal. It's punishment. So how can it be civil?
But I believe that you still need the analysis of what is, first of all, this court has also said that RC 2950 is punitive. And I would argue that this court should, because the offense of failure to notify of a change of address is, I'm not saying it's not an offense and it can't be prosecuted. Okay, Mr. Howard was prosecuted. And he was rightfully prosecuted. There was no motion to dismiss filed in the trial court. There was no argument made that it shouldn't have been a conviction. However, I think given the nature of this offense, one must look, this court has made it clear, the rules under Megan's Law apply to his duty to notify. And that goes back to the plea that was entered at the time. That is different than someone pleading guilty to a driving while under the influence, being told it was one, that at that time, if you pick up another, it might be a felony of the fourth degree. Subsequently, doing it again and the charge being higher.
But that's where you're losing. I don't see where the difference is. If you follow the state's argument, it's a new offense committed at a subsequent time. Using your driving while under the influence analogy, how are those two concepts different? You're told when you plead to this driving while under the influence that a subsequent conviction could be, let's say, 2 years in prison, but by the time that person commits the second one, it's now elevated to where they can face 4 years in prison. How is that different from the scenario that we have here?
Because I come back to, I believe, while maybe saying it is civil, it's a criminal act, but it is an act that is the basis of an agreement that was made at the time, part of which is being advised you have a duty to notify of a change of address. And that is the basis. It is not the basis, because for the same argument, I don't think at the time the blood alcohol requirement was 0.1. Mm-hmm. And a subsequent event, it might be 0.08. It wouldn't have been a conviction back then. And you can't argue, well, at the time I picked up the first one, it was 0.1. This time I was at 0.09, so therefore I'm not responsible or shouldn't be enhanced. I don't think that argument would go. But the fact is, he was advised at the time of his plea in 2000 what the penalties were, what the requirements were, and what the penalties were. And I believe, given the nature of this offense, and this is specific to 2950, I believe there is a distinction because the rules were set up in 2000 at the time of that plea to a rape conviction.
So you believe it's part and parcel of the original sentence?
I do.
So are you? Is there a distinction here? Because in this situation, the defendant has an ongoing duty to do something proactive. They have to do something, whereas in the DUI or the weapons under a disability, there's no onus on the defendant to do something. In other words, it's if they later drink and drive again, or they later pick up a weapon, that's a activity that is unrelated to their first conviction, and the first conviction is only used as an enhancement, and it's not a part of a series of proactive requirements.
Correct, and I think By the same token, that a court can't go back to someone who hasn't committed a new offense, but to say, wait a minute, you were convicted at a time when DUI was X, it's now been increased. Obviously, that can't be done. And I think that is what I'm arguing, is that you're going back to what the rules were at the time that he entered into this. He was told what he needed to do. He was advised. It is not of record whether it was told. We can assume. We can't assume whether he was told in open court what the offenses were or not. We can assume that that was part of the discussion at the time he enters a plea and makes a decision on that.
But your client's duty to register has never varied or never changed, has it?
Say that again?
Your client's duty to register was always the same from the time of his plea. He always had that duty.
Yes. I guess it changed for there is a period where it may have changed because he was reclassified for a period between...
Well, during the...
There is that gap
general.
Period.
Yeah.
But he had the duty to notify of a change of address did not change.
Mm-hmm. So, Mr. Latch...
That duty never changed. But the state's argument is really, had he violated up until the time the legislature changed the penalty, he would have had the Megan Law penalty as an habitual offender. But the legislature has the right to increase the penalty, and because he violated after the penalty had been increased, he should be subject to the increased penalty. And that's the essence of what the state is asking us to consider.
And my argument is that it should not apply retroactively.
Well, it's not a retroactive application because if you hear what the state is arguing, they say look to the date of the failure to register. And had he done it before the penalty increased, he would have received the Megan Law penalty. But since he did it subsequent to the increase in penalty under Adam Walsh, then he's subject to the Adam Walsh penalty. And we've had legislative changes in crimes in enhancing or increasing penalties for offenses in the past, and we've generally gone with that date. So why is the state's argument something we should reject?
Because I believe where this court has gone through Bodike, from Bodike, through Gingell, through Williams, that 2950 is a different analysis.
Mr. Letchman, if we looked at it, we're talking analogies, if we looked at it analyzing more to probation violations or parole violations, at the time of the sentence, the obligation to register is imposed as part of the sentence, and the duty is there so that the individual is told, if you don't do this, here's what your penalty is. So it seems to me, rather than calling it a different offense, because there's always that obligation, if the obligation is not met, then what the defendant was told at the time should be the penalty imposed.
And that's where I make the analogy in my brief to a community control violation. Using the same argument, whether it's a felony DUI, whether it is weapons under disability, if you violate the terms of your community control sanctions and you are brought back into court for failure to report, for whatever, for violating some term, not picking up a new charge, you can't be sentenced, and if the sentence was an F5 and now the sentence for a weapons under disability is an F1, that person can't go back in front of the court and have the court say to that individual, it's now an F1, I'm sending you to prison for 10 years versus the 12 months I was capped at the time you originally were put on probation.
But you are getting a new crime, which is the distinction here. You're saying that a failure to do a term of your probation will trigger imposition of your original sentence, provided that's not a new crime. It's just a failure to meet a criteria or a condition. And here, there's no doubt. We all agree that it's a new crime.
It is.
So that's where that analogy falls down.
Again, and that's where I come back to, and I don't want to be repetitive, but it's the nature of what the new crime stems
from. Well, that's what I want to have clarified, because Did I hear you say that registration is civil?
I just think it's the, and that's because, and I think as Justice Cupp indicated, it's still a failure to do it results in a indictment and a crime. But I believe the requirements under Megan's Law are civil in that there's a string of things that one who is registered as a sex offender must comply with.
Well, we never, our case law didn't say that the requirements under Megan's Law, you know, cross the line and become punitive and then are therefore classified as more criminal in nature. That was the declaration, I believe, after Adam Walsh Act.
Right.
So I guess maybe... there is more of a civil overtone to Megan's Law requirements than the Adam Walsh.
And this court, I think, and that's where it gets, this court, I think, with cases like Cook and Ferguson that came and were analyzed under Megan's Law, that's what this court in Williams really went back and took a look at the punitive versus remedial nature of 2950 under Adam Walsh Act. And we're in the world of Adam Walsh Act at this point, but I think the court has held that Adam Walsh Act is, the 2950
right.
is now punitive. The court comes out and says all doubt has been removed that RC 2950 is punitive.
But under Megan's Law, even if the registration requirement was civil, failure to comply with it was a criminal offense.
It was. It was. And but the issue is, should it be, should the person, because there's no question as a habitual sexual offender that he was subject to requirements, and the issue is, and I am encouraging this court to follow the line of cases up through Williams and find that Mr. Howard's violation of his failure to notify of a change of address amounts to the court should apply the penalty as the second appellate district did at the time of the offense and make it a felony of the fifth degree.
Thank you. Ms. Nostein, you have used all your time, but you may have 30 seconds.
I would just quickly point out that I think the idea under that this court addressed in Ferguson was that the Megan's Law classification is what the court called a collateral consequence. It may have said that in Cook, a collateral consequence only. And going back to the idea that there's no reasonable expectation of finality, the court said in Ferguson, there's no reasonable expectation of finality in this collateral consequence either. So kind of regardless of whatever Mr. Howard may have been told at the time that he was classified, just like Ferguson, when later amendments to Megan's Law came along, this court said, you know, that Ferguson had to abide by those because there was no expectation of finality that this collateral consequence would never change. I think that's what the court said in Ferguson, and it really still applies. One other matter, what was punitive in Williams was the court decided that the registration requirements had finally gotten to be so onerous, so burdensome, so strict, that's what is punitive now. It's the classification and the registration requirements. The penalty section was always punitive, probably. I mean, even under Megan's Law, it's the penalty for a crime, for failing to notify. That's always been punitive.
But this particular scheme of penalization for failure to notify of a change of address, going from the potential for 12 months to up to the potential of 10 years, I don't think that there's any argument that is a huge change.
It's a big change.
So, thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decisions. Thank you.